It began as a way to preserve old fish, but became a way for millions to eat raw fish fast. This leads one to ask, how did the way of the samurai become the American way of sushi on the go?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 545th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Nagasaki who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello.
Kelsey Olson back from college.
Good morning.
Parmalee Taff on sales. Hello, Parmalee.
Good morning.
Folks, there is some sushi at home in the refrigerator, but I am under strict orders not to touch. Now, when I was, some things are worth fighting for, I guess, and for daughter Kelsey, it's her sushi. Now, when I was Kelsey's age, only heathens ate raw fish, or so we suspected. But today, sushi and sashimi have become as American as, dare we say it, apple pie. How did the way of the samurai become the American way of sushi on the go? Today, we have somebody who can help us find an answer to this. His name is Trevor Corson, and he is the author of The Zen of Fish. Trevor, welcome to the Food Chain.
Great to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So, The Zen of Fish and The Secret Life of Lobsters, what led you to the sea?
Yeah, The Secret Life of Lobsters was my first book, and that started out after I had spent a couple of years working on lobster fishing boats out in Maine, and I started to get to know the fishermen, and then I started to get to know some scientists who were doing collaborative research with fishermen, and then I got to know the lobsters, and then there was no turning back.
So you were like the Herman Melville of the lobster industry,
yeah.
Right?
Exactly. They are fascinating creatures, boy, and the hijinks that go on down under in the on the ocean floor were definitely enough to make a seafood bodice ripper out of. So that was my first book. And then to get to the subject of sushi, I had lived in Japan for 3 years, and I learned to speak Japanese and that kind of thing. And so I had an interest in that. And for my second book, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write about. And, I liked the seafood theme. I was having fun with that, but I wanted to do something that had an Asian twist. So sushi was the obvious solution. So I set out to write a book on sushi.
Well, what is in sushi that creates so much passion about eating it? My daughter Kelsey, you know, a little bit of sushi in the refrigerator, and we'll fight over it.
Yeah, and I heard from a woman in Wisconsin the other day who's 5-year-old daughter refuses to eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, but she'll eat sashimi if you serve it to her properly.
Right.
And it's extraordinary. And when I set out to write this book, I realized that sushi had really become an American phenomenon, not just the Japanese one. So I was trying to look into that, and I wanted to, I write for an American audience, basically, so I wanted to find an American story about sushi, and I did not have any trouble. I ended up finding some young Americans who are training to become sushi chefs in Los Angeles, and the book is a story about their trials
kind
and tribulations.
Kind of follows them along, and it's something I wanted to pick up down the line a bit. But what's in sushi that drives us so crazy? What do you love about it?
That's what I was trying to figure out, and so I was talking to a lot of Americans who ate sushi and Americans who'd seen sushi come into the U.S. a number of decades ago and just explode in popularity. And I got a few ideas the more I learned about sushi, and these are pet theories of mine about why it's become so popular in the U.S. But I think one of them is that as Americans, we don't really have a shared common culture, for instance, the way they do in Japan. So we're really into new stuff, and we love finding something new and something that's exotic and has a little cachet and something that our friends don't necessarily know about. We like to be the first one to discover it and introduce it to our friends. So I think that's part of what's behind how popular sushi's become, because it is a very exotic meal. And if you're the first one on your block to eat sushi, it's pretty exciting, and you can, you know, introduce your friends to it. But there's another more pedestrian theory I have, which is that around the same time that sushi started to become popular in the U.S., Americans were starting to pay more attention to their diet and wanting to start to eat healthier and not eat so much red meat and so much fat and that kind of thing. So sushi came along just when, you know, the health virtues of fish were being talked about, and it seemed like a very healthy meal, but it was also quite tasty. And this is a sort of myth that I uncover in the book, which is kind of funny, that people assume sushi is automatically really good for you, but it's not necessarily automatically a health food. One of the reasons it tastes so good is because sushi rice is full of sugar. It's very sweet, so you got lots of carbs and lots of sugar in there. And I think that's one of the reasons why we like it so much, because it sort of combines those two things I'm talking about. It seems very exotic and exciting and different, but when you get down to it, what defines the taste of sushi, which is that sweet, tart rice, that's an easy flavor to take, and it is really yummy.
Now, we should probably distinguish between sushi and sashimi, because sushi really is sticky rice, right?
That's exactly right. The word sushi does not have anything to do with fish. It doesn't refer to fish or raw fish or anything like that. The word sushi specifically refers to what I just described, rice that has been seasoned with vinegar, sugar, and a little salt. And different sushi bars have different combinations and recipes for, you know, their own recipe for that. But that's the basic combination. And sashimi refers to any raw meat, regardless of whether it's served with what kind of rice. And sashimi goes way back, well before sushi came along in Japanese history. And it could have been, in the old days, the Japanese aristocrats ate wild boar sashimi and crane sashimi, as well as fish sashimi. So it's two entirely separate traditions, and the word sushi doesn't necessarily have anything to do with raw fish.
You know, you were just talking about a little five-year-old girl in Wisconsin that likes her sashimi. And when you think about it, you can get raw fish in Bismarck, North Dakota, 365 days a year now. And when you think about it, that's really amazing. It wasn't always this way, of course. I can remember when it wasn't this way. So where did all of this sushi stuff begin? Can you kind of take us back?
Sure, yeah. Well, and I have this several different storylines running through the book. Mm-hmm. One of them is how sushi began way, way, way back a couple thousand years ago, and another is how it came to America. And
well, I like the part that you talk about in World War II. I mean, that was really seemed to be the place where, you know, in occupying Japan, U.S. soldiers really got to know sushi that way.
That was very surprising. What's really surprising is that sushi as we know it today is almost didn't make it. It almost died out at several points in Japanese history. And it had become popular in the 1800s in Tokyo as a kind of fast food, a sort of street snack, kind of the McDonald's drive-through of old Tokyo. And what happened, what you're referring to, is that after World War II, you know, Tokyo had been devastated by bombing raids and all that kind of thing, and the whole economy had shut down, and food was rationed, and it was... And sushi was in danger of dying out at that point. And it was actually the American military occupation authorities who were the ones who decided that sushi ought to be the new type of cuisine that they would spread around the country to try to restart the restaurant industry to get the economy going again.
Get the economy going.
Yeah, so we really owe it to General MacArthur and his bureaucrats after the war. For the spread of sushi today all over Japan and then around the rest of the world.
And they enacted some laws with respect to how sushi was going to be distributed that had an impact on the way sushi was served, correct?
Right. In fact, many different types of sushi throughout Japan And the one that we know is simply Tokyo-style sushi. And because the U.S. occupation authorities were based in Tokyo, and they started, they ran a trial system of this sushi restaurant thing in Tokyo. So they just wrote up a regulation that said, okay, well, people can bring in their ration of rice, and a sushi chef can make it into exactly this number of nigiri and maybe one sushi roll. And they specified it all out because they were just using Tokyo-style sushi as an example. and then it worked pretty well in Tokyo. So they just instituted this system with the exact same regulations throughout the whole country. And suddenly all the different regional varieties of sushi that had existed in Japan, which none of us have ever heard about, were more or less wiped out because the U.S. Military demanded that everyone in throughout Japan make Tokyo-style sushi, in particular, you know, a certain number of pieces and everything for a certain amount of rice. So it was highly regulated.
There you go. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking sushi with Trevor Corson, who's the author of The Zen of Fish. And you, care to participate? Love to hear what you have to say. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phones and join us. We're talking sushi. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about sushi and how sushi went from being the way of the samurai way back when and ended up as being the American way to eat raw fish fast. And it's incredibly popular these days, and you can see sushi restaurants in every city in America, and it's truly amazing that it happened so fast. And today we're fishing around for the explanation of how this seafood combination kind of swept the country and took over the world. We've got Trevor Corson, who's the author of The Zen of Fish, and who speaks Japanese and was allowed into the world of sushi, and so he's bringing that world to us through his book and through his conversation today. We were talking about how sushi really was introduced to us at the end of World War II, when the United States occupied Japan and helped to rebuild that country. And I guess where we left off, Trevor, was that through the good offices of General Douglas MacArthur, he kind of standardized the sushi industry in Japan, right?
That's right. And so the sushi, as I was saying, the sushi that we're familiar with today is basically just Tokyo-style sushi, and there are many other varieties around the country. Mm-hmm. And it is the Tokyo variety that was standardized in Japan, and then that in the 1960s and the 70s started to get a toehold in the United States.
So there you are, 1960s and 70s. It wasn't that long ago at all. And here it is everywhere now. In your book, The Zen of Fish, you talk a lot about the difficulty and how difficult it is to become a bona fide sushi chef. And you follow some people as they make their way through an American sushi school, which is a little bit different than a Japanese sushi school. So what is the difference between American sushi and Japanese sushi?
Yeah, when sushi arrived in the U.S., it started to transform. And there were a couple of ways in which that happened. One of the big differences between American sushi and Japanese sushi is that we kind of turned the sushi eating experience into what we're more familiar with, which is to say, when we go out to eat, we generally sit down at a table and order off a menu. So most Japanese restaurants that serve sushi in the United States tend to mostly have tables and menus, and, you know, that's what we're used to. But in Japan, typically and traditionally, the sushi eating experience doesn't really involve either tables or menus. What defines it in Japan is the sushi bar. And you see these sushi bars in restaurants, and, you know, some Americans are familiar with sitting at the sushi bar. But many aren't, because they don't know what to do there. They don't know how to order. They're not sure how it works. So it's just safer to sit at a table. But in Japan, you walk into a typical traditional sushi bar, and they may not have any tables at all. If they do, just a very few. And most people are sitting at the bar. And what that means is that they aren't even being given a menu per se. They're just going into the bar, sitting down, and then interacting with the chef. And so in Japan, the sushi chef tends to be a bit not just like a chef, but also like a bartender, sort of having this social interaction with his customers while he's working.
So there's some entertainment value that has to be built into the chef.
There's some entertainment value. There's some socializing. There's often long-term relationships and friendships between customers and chefs. And there, and what this allows is for the chef to... Well, it allows the customer, in a way, to relinquish control and just put their trust in the chef and say, you know, what do you recommend today? What's good? What fish do you have that you would like to serve me? What would you like
Which
to do?
Which fish is fresh, right?
Yeah. Right, right. So I...
And if you're friends with the sushi chef, you get the fresh fish. And if you're not friends, you get the other fish, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's one thing I recommend to people. People always ask me, oh, where do I go to get the best sushi? And the answer really is just go to your neighborhood sushi bar regularly and get to know the chef. And that's how you get the best sushi, because the chef is going to give the people he knows
the
best.
So there's a connection. In reading parts of your book, The Zen of Fish, I realized that that was a big part of the popularity of the sushi restaurants in Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
That relationship between sushi chefs and movie stars.
Yeah, yeah. I describe the gentleman, the Japanese chef who owns the Sushi Academy, where I spent 3 months hanging out to get the story. I was writing about these young American sushi chef apprentices. This Japanese chef began his career in Los Angeles and Hollywood in the late 70s, working behind a sushi bar where, just as you say, a lot of Hollywood celebrities were some of the first people to discover sushi and first Americans to discover sushi and embrace it. And that was part of what they embraced, was this wonderful experience of interacting with the Japanese chef. And, of course, immediately it was, you know, kind of a different experience than you would have in Japan, a bit more wild in Hollywood in the late 70s and early 80s. And this Japanese chef, Toshi Sugiura, who I write about in the book, and his story is sort of also the story of how sushi came to America. You know, he describes sort of wild nights behind the sushi bar serving sushi to, you know, Olivia Newton-John and Neil Diamond and Barbara Streisand.
So he developed a lot of cachet by working with Hollywood stars, and then they... told their friends about it, and away it goes, right?
Yeah, and I think that's another reason why sushi took off in the U.S. is because these Hollywood celebrities who were up for anything, they were kind of crazy and always wanted to try something exotic and something new, they were the ones who really embraced it first in the U.S., and I think that that definitely gave it the cachet necessary for it to be taken up by the general public.
And how did it spread across the country so quickly? I mean, was it the fact that we were looking at Hollywood and seeing what the stars were doing? Is that a big part of it?
I think that's become part of it, certainly. But for a long time, sushi was mostly relegated to a few urban centers, particularly on the coast, L.A., New York City. Sushi also started out early in New York City, but, you know, it's not surprising considering what a cosmopolitan place New York is. But Chicago also actually was pretty early with sushi and started out there. But again, in Chicago, one of the early sushi restaurants there was right across the street from Second City, where the comedy club where people like John Belushi were working. And again, so it was these sort of Hollywood types or actors who would start eating sushi. And then, of course, John Belushi went on to do his great Samurai Deli Chef skits on Saturday Night Live, which also helped popularize it. But what's happened since is that the popularity of sushi has definitely now, you know, spread beyond those coastal urban centers and places like Chicago, and now it is really going into the Midwest. I think the spread of sushi stands in supermarkets has been a large influence on introducing people to sushi, and, you know, even in the suburbs or in Midwestern states. I think that's had a lot to do with it. And the people I talked to when I was researching my book described, for example, they were getting calls from Kansas City and Oklahoma and all kinds of places like this asking for sushi chefs. And a lot of these were sushi restaurants being opened not by Asians at all, but by regular old, you know, Caucasian Americans who had seen the popularity of sushi and were trying to jump on that wave of sushi spreading into the Midwest.
And now there's sushi restaurants everywhere.
Yeah, they really are everywhere.
When I put out the word that I was going to do a program on sushi, somebody emailed me and suggested that I Google Reverend Moon plus sushi.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And I came up with this interesting story in the Chicago Tribune.
Right.
About the impact the Unification Church has had on the sushi industry in the United States. And I wanted to pick this up when we come back from the upcoming break and ask you what kind of impact you think the Unification Church has had in the development of the sushi industry here in the United States. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. This is Sushi Day and Sashimi Day. And we've got Trevor Corson, who's the author of The Zen of Fish. And we have you. So if you have any questions about sushi, pick up your phones and join him today, because we have a guy who's been looking into the subject for a number of years and has come out with a book on it. And he is Mr. Fish, Trevor Corson, author of The Zen of Fish. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. Phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Thank you. Hey, welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. We're talking about sushi and sashimi with Trevor Corson, who is the author of The Zen of Fish. Trevor, we're talking here in the studio about the difference between Japanese sushi and American sushi. What is the difference?
Well, one of the things that happened when sushi came to America was that the sushi roll, which has seaweed on the outside in traditional Japanese sushi, seemed not so appetizing to Americans because of that seaweed. Americans weren't necessarily going to eat seaweed. Raw fish, maybe, but not seaweed. So at some point early on in sushi's arrival in Los Angeles, chefs figured out that if they inverted the sushi roll, basically turning it inside out so that the seaweed was hidden inside and the rice was on the outside, that Americans would be much more eager to eat it. So they started doing that, making these inside-out rolls, including the California roll, which came along fairly soon after that. It's an American invention, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It was avocado and crab meat are the usual ingredients. These inside-out rolls suddenly became very popular. They were very easy to eat. As I said, the sushi rice was tart, but also very sweet, which is a very tasty combination, very similar to sweet and sour chicken, just sweet and sour rice, basically. And so these rolls spread dramatically, and now in the U.S., rolls are really the center of sushi for us. The nigiri, which are the little hand-formed packs of rice with a slice of fish on top, are less common in the U.S. It's the reverse in Japan. In Japan, the nigiri are the center of sushi, and the rolls are basically just an afterthought. They might make you a small roll at the end of the night to make sure you go home with a full belly, but they do not traditionally make any of these inside-out rolls with all kinds of ingredients that we have in the U.S.
Hmm. Interesting. Let's go to the Unification Church, and in just reading this article in the Chicago Tribune, they talk about how in the early 70s, the Reverend Sun Myung Moon decided to set out and develop a vertically integrated fish business in which they would essentially kind of take over the fish world. And this seems to have done pretty much that. They're a company called True World Foods, builds fishing boats around the world, owns fishing ports, owns 22 distribution centers here in the United States, has 230 trucks that sell sushi to 9,000 sushi restaurants. Wow. I had no idea. Did you run into this phenomenon?
Yeah, well, I mean, I learned about it in the course of my research, and, you know, it's striking. I mean, it's very striking, but I looked into it a bit, and as far as I could tell, there's really nothing particularly untoward about this. I mean, the Unification Church is...
Well, I don't know if there's anything untoward about it, but it seems like somebody was planning the sushi industry and did a good job of planning it.
Well, I don't know that. I'm hesitant to say that the Unification Church is responsible for the popularity of sushi in America. I think that probably they saw a growing business opportunity. I mean, the growth of sushi was pretty obvious, happening in the, especially in the early 90s, just spreading everywhere. And I think they saw a business opportunity and they jumped right in it. And they have a great organization. They have great organizational skills, and they actually did a very good job.
That's what it appears to me, is that they did a great job of pulling this whole industry together.
Yeah. I mean, they landed in Gloucester, Massachusetts, you know, this bastion of traditional Portuguese and Italian-American fishing industry, you know, which couldn't be more hostile, one would imagine, to, you know, Unification Church from Korea. And they made friends there and really, you know, seemed to go about it in a very conscientious way to earn business there within the fish trade. It's a very interesting phenomenon, it's hard for me to imagine that sushi has been one of those industries where, you know, large corporate entities have been able to create new demand, because at the local level, I mean, it really comes down to, you know, one after another individual people opening up restaurants in specific places one at a time. But you are now starting to see some you know, large corporate chains looking into sushi, or at least Japanese food. You know, the Chinese food restaurant chain P.F. Chang's has been looking into sushi. So we may yet see the spread of corporate franchise sushi.
So the Unification Church, this New World Foods, like I said, it has 22 distribution centers around the United States, delivering fresh raw fish to 9,000 restaurants. That's just an incredible performance. And, you know, I mentioned earlier the fact that you can get fresh raw fish in 365 days a year in Minot, North Dakota, or someplace like that. That, you know, traditionally you'd never see raw fish, and yet there it is. And I guess that the Unification Church is partially responsible for us being able to do that, right?
Yeah, but, you know, air freight is also partly responsible. FedEx, all this kind of thing. It's the spread, the ability to transport fish by air. You know, the freezing technologies have improved dramatically. A lot of the tuna we're getting in our sushi has been flash frozen using special high-tech techniques that involve liquid nitrogen and stuff aboard fishing boats, you know, when it's first caught. And then, you know, it preserved very well. You know, it's often hard to tell whether the fish is fresh or been frozen using these technologies.
I often think it's better to have fresh frozen fish rather than fresh fish that hasn't been frozen and has been fresh too long, right?
Yeah, that may be true. And also with the issue of parasites, you know, there are parasites out there in fish, particularly fish that spend any time in freshwater, like salmon. Those you definitely want to eat frozen. You don't want those to be fresh at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing that there's this huge, and I mean, I think the Unification Church industry sector is a great example of how dramatic this industrial operation has become in terms of fish supply. And it does raise the question of whether all this is, you know, good for the fish, because it may be that we're using up so much fish and so much energy in the transport of all these fish and everything that, you know, I don't know if this is sustainable. We may be living in a moment of widespread global sushi that, you know, if we keep up at this rate, may not last.
Well, one wonders how it can possibly last if there's 9,000 sushi restaurants around the country serving fresh fish. One wonders about the nature of the fish we're eating anyway, and with respect to tuna, one knows that, well, there's a source of mercury, right?
Yeah, with any fish, you should be worrying, you know, whether it's in sushi or not, you should be worrying about this. Not with any fish per se, because some fish are more susceptible to these issues than others, and, you know, every consumer needs to educate themselves about this. Tuna is one to worry about, because it's high on the food chain, and so there are issues with the mercury accumulation in the fat, and there are issues with PCB accumulation, also with farmed salmon. They've been many farms, types of farmed salmon have been shown to have much higher levels of PCBs than wild salmon. So as, you know, this fits perfectly into the previous topic, which is that as the volume of fish to supply the sushi trade has increased dramatically, a lot more of these fish are coming from aquaculture operations, from fish farming operations.
Which is something to be at least concerned about.
Yeah, it is. And in the book, you know, as you follow the students through their story of learning to become sushi chefs, I spend a little time on each of the major ingredients in sushi and talk a little bit about this.
Let's pick that up when we get back from the break.
Sure.
This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking sushi with Trevor Carson, author of Zen of Fish and You. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. What are the ingredients? Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
What do you think out there? How long can we sustain the world's fisheries when we love to eat sushi the way we do? When we have these wonderful fish restaurants around the world, and there's so many of us, and we just seem to be eating it up as fast as we possibly can. What do you think, Trevor?
Well, one of the interesting things that I learned writing this book was that the fish that are most endangered now, particularly the large tuna, are not necessarily the fish that were traditionally considered the most desirable in sushi in Japan.
And we love the tuna because it has a lot of fat content, right?
Yeah, you think about the pinnacle of sushi is considered to be the toro, the fatty belly cuts of tuna.
Mm-hmm.
When I went back and did some research on sushi a number of decades ago in Japan, these cuts of fish were considered completely inedible and were cut off and thrown to the cats to eat. So there's been a real transformation. And, you know, I in the book, I hope people will be entertained by the story and the characters and, you know, learn the wonderful, surprising facts about sushi and the different ingredients and stuff. But I also hope that they'll start to think about eating sushi in a slightly different way, maybe, and realize that they can make different choices that not only will help them appreciate the adventure of eating sushi more, but also, you know, maybe have a better impact environmentally, because you can choose fish. The traditional fish that were considered the pinnacle of sushi were not fatty tuna or fatty salmon. They were the leaner, lighter-fleshed fish, like flounder or snapper, or some of these fish. And they're very interesting fish to eat. It's subtler. You don't want to be putting lots of wasabi and soy sauce on these fish. You want to be just closing your eyes and chewing slowly and appreciating the subtle textures and flavors. But you're really going to end up being a more authentic gourmand, you know, appreciator of sushi that way.
Well, speaking of soy sauce and wasabi, here in the United States, we seem to slather a lot of it on our sushi. It's almost like we're hiding things with it. Is it the same way in Japan?
No, things are a bit different, and this is also something that I include in the book. And I also, which is to say, you know, sort of the basic etiquette of eating sushi. And I've also put some of the stuff on my website.
Oh, good. What is it?
Yeah, if listeners want to go to zenoffish.com,
Zenoffish.com?
Yeah, just it's the title of the book, Zen of Fish.
Oh, the Zenoffish.com.
Mm-hmm. Good. Mm-hmm. The title of the book, Z-E-N of Fish. Mm-hmm. And I've got a link there called How to Eat Sushi. And what I'm hoping is that people will kind of get down the basics for eating at the sushi bar so that they can feel more comfortable going and doing that and have a different sort of experience by interacting with the chef. But what this has to do with soy sauce and wasabi is that generally you're not really supposed to stir extra wasabi into your soy sauce at all. Many Americans like to do that, and they like to put lots of extra wasabi on because we've sort of automatically come to think that one of the key flavors of sushi is the spiciness of wasabi.
Right.
And that's not really the case. And in Japan, sushi chefs, and at the better sushi bars, the sushi chefs won't serve you extra wasabi. They put just the right amount, a very small amount, inside the sushi itself. And that's really all you need because, you know, I talk to so many sushi chefs who told me, you know, I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get down to the fish market and pick out the best fish for my customers, and when they put all that wasabi and soy sauce on it, they can't even taste the fish, which is true. And I've done some experiments myself,
sure.
It's really true. And
it's almost like we use it so much of it, it's almost like we're using it to hide the taste of fish rather than...
Well, yeah, in a way, it makes you wonder if that's what we are doing subconsciously or something. And it's wonderful to leave that stuff off the sushi, maybe a tiny bit of soy sauce, just a touch, and really appreciate, you know, what are the differences in these subtle flavors of these different fish, because I talk in the book a very interesting physiology of fish flesh, the chemical makeup of fish proteins and stuff, mm-hmm. which makes raw fish a very interesting thing to eat if you know how to appreciate it.
Go for that. What do you mean?
Well, one of the things is that fish is easy to eat raw compared with any other type of meat because fish are in the water, which means that they don't have to fight gravity all the time.
Right.
The rest of us, you know, cows and pigs and birds and everything, we're always fighting against gravity, which means our muscle is full of all kinds of connective tissue and collagen, which helps keep the muscles intact against the drag of gravity, which means you've got to roast or cook all these meats. And you don't have to do that with fish, which means that you can appreciate the flavors that are there. And in fact, it's actually very easy to ruin the taste of fish by cooking it too much. And what fish actually has, in many cases, more flavor compounds in the meat than, say, beef does. But they're subtler. And part of what creates that is the fact that because fish live generally in salt water, their meat is full of all kinds of molecules that are designed to counteract the osmotic pressure of salt water. It's getting a little esoteric,
yeah.
But what that means is that they have all these little molecules in their flesh that create flavor. But if you cook them, those molecules break down and don't taste as interesting.
Okay, this is a Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Trevor Corson, author of The Zen of Fish and thezenoffish.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll finish up. Do stay tuned. Well, about a bunch of years ago, I was in Hong Kong and had the opportunity to sit in on this magnificent Asian dinner, one of those 39 course dinners, and somewhere along course number 27 or something, they served some raw fish, and as soon as I swallowed that raw fish, I knew I was in big trouble, and boy was I ever in big trouble, and I had the worst case of dysentery that I've ever could possibly imagine. And for the past number of years, I've been unable to even face the thought of raw fish again. But here I am talking sushi and getting kind of hungry for some sushi. And so I'm asking Trevor Corson, who's the author of The Zen of Fish, what do I do when I go to the sushi restaurant? How do I have a great experience, Trevor?
Well, sit at the sushi bar and read my how to eat sushi tips on thezenoffish.com and tell the chef that you're not sure you want to eat straight up raw fish and see if he has some suggestions for you. You know, there are snobby sushi bars where they'll kick you out if you say that, but then that's not where you want to be eating anyway.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of other options. A sushi chef ought to be able to be creative and think on his feet. That's part of the training, as I learned from watching the students go through their training that I write about. And in fact, one of the very interesting things I learned also was that traditionally Japanese sushi aficionados actually consider just plain old raw fish to be pretty uninteresting and not really authentic sushi. Because in the old days, sushi, you know, obviously in the 1800s, it evolved before the advent of refrigeration.
Right.
So sushi chefs were very skilled at preserving fish, particularly at pickling it, using salt and vinegar to prevent a fish from spoiling, which actually is a very good thing to do in terms of flavor, because preserving a fish a bit longer than would normal, you know, than it would normally spoil, but not cooking it allows those flavor molecules that I was talking about before to really come to their peak. And so what a traditional skilled sushi chef is doing is actually kind of the art of compromise. He's allowing the fish to not quite spoil, but to age a little bit to let that flavor come out. So there's options you can have for pickled mackerel, which is a very interesting kind of sushi that I like that's been salted and vinegared. So maybe that's something to try, not completely raw.
Well, it sounds like fun. I guess I'm going to have to try it. But what about that worry that I picked up, you know, another piece of the wrong fish? You ever run across that?
Well, in this day and age, we can get E. coli from eating salad greens
that we
buy at our local supermarket.
Right.
So, you know, everything has
risks. Has its risks,
it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the thing about sushi is that because it is so much of it is raw, the people in the distribution chain and the chefs, they're all paying quite a bit of attention to this and perhaps more attention to it than you would be getting at a typical restaurant for some other kind of cuisine where, you know, sure, maybe they cook it, but maybe they don't cook it all the way and then you might be in trouble.
So your favorite sushi?
Well, I got a hankering for a very light-fleshed snapper with a little dollop of something called yuzu kosho, which one of the sushi chefs I got to know introduced me to, which is it's a mash of a citrus fruit in Japan called yuzu, an Asian citrus fruit, and chili pepper, and this is mashed together in a little tiny dollop instead of wasabi on a slice of lean, clear flesh snapper on a little pack of rice. Boy, that was one of the most heavy.
Thank you, Trevor Corson, the Zen of Fish. Thank you all for tuning in to The Food Chain. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.